You've been saying for a while that the first interest rate increase could come in March of next year. I think you first mentioned it, in fact, when we talked to you in St. Louis and we asked you about your dot. And now the minutes released by the FOMC on Wednesday show that more people on the Fed are looking at the data and saying, maybe that first interest rate increase could come sooner. Is the consensus view, sort of the weight of the majority on the FOMC starting coming around more to your view now?
I think the weight of the evidence is leaning toward earlier increase than would have been in the works earlier this year. And that's because labor markets have improved quite a bit relative to what the committee was thinking. And so I think, to the extent there's a rethink on this, it's because of improving labor markets.
And there is that kind of a rethink? Is that what the minutes reflect?
You just think last year, at the June press conference, Chairman Bernanke said that unemployment in the summer of 2014 would be 7% and we'd be finished with QE. And what has turned out is that we're at 6.2% and we're not done with QE. So it's quite a bit different from what we would have been thinking would happen a year ago. And a lot of that improvement in the unemployment rate has come in the last 6 months. Some before that, I guess. But job growth has been over 200,000 a month, this year.
So. Okay, so then that's an accurate read then, that the FOMC is rethinking broadly.
I can only speak for myself. You have to ask the other guys.
True, but we did get the minutes and you were at the meeting, and one of the reasons we get those minutes is to send us a belayed, thoughtful message about where the FOMC is.
Well, they're all here, so I think you can ask them.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. Another point raised in those minutes was some more discussion and some more people saying that they're getting less comfortable with having a forward guidance that says the key rate will be at zero for a considerable period. Is that the sense you get, too, that there's more question of that on the FOMC and in your own mind?
Well, the considerable period language will have to be revisited at some point. And I think, to me, the original intention, at least from my point of view, of having that language in there was that when we ended the QE program, it did not necessarily mean we were immediately going to turn around and raise interest rates. I think we wanted to have some breathing space in there so that we could look at the data and make a decision about what we wanted to do. But as we get closer to the date where QE ends, then I think we have to think about, well, how do we want to reshape our thinking on this? You can't just keep saying considerable period forever.
Well, do you agree that maybe it should be dropped right now?
Well, I think it's something the committee will review in upcoming meetings, and I wouldn't want to prejudge where that's going to come out.
Do you have any sense of what considerable period even means? Is it supposed to be 6 months or more than 9 months?
You can ask other people on the committee what they thought. Some of these things are a product of compromise on the committee. But for me, I thought the intention was to make sure that just because QE ends, that doesn't mean that the next meeting, we're going to turn around and raise interest rates. So I think it was to give some breathing room for the committee and allow us to assess the situation at that point. Otherwise, markets might have thought, you're going to raise rates. You won't have anything else to do. You're done tapering. So now you're going to have to raise the policy rate. And that's not been the intention of the committee.
But there's no months like it has to be 6 months or 3 months or 9 months. So what considerable period
can
be just
very
about
reluctant.
Anything.
I'd be very reluctant to put an express, an exact time frame on it because it is very data dependent. And, part of it is a committee wants to have the chance to assess the data and assess the state of the economy.
Are you still comfortable with looking for an interest rate increase in March? Are you seeing anything that would signal maybe even a need to move it up a little more quickly?
For now, I'm sticking with the end of March on my projection, and that's based on a second half of 2014 GDP growth rate that'll be over 3%. If you look at a lot of the tracking forecasts, they're over 3% for the U.S. economy, combined with the second quarter at 4%. And last year came in at 3%. So really, I think we've got a pretty good growth track record and prospective growth outlook. It's just that we had that one first quarter that is puzzling everybody. But if you look at all the quarters around that it's looking pretty good. And so if we get more confirmation of that as we go through the fall, then I think we'll be in good shape for the end of the first quarter to think about raising rates at that point.
You said recently economists are right to worry the Fed could fall behind the curve on inflation. It's the history of the institution. Are you seeing signs of this now?
Well, it's easy for a central bank to get behind where financial market expectations are. And, you know, it's a bureaucracy and it tends to be slow moving. And markets are fast moving. They're responding to current data. So if the committee doesn't keep up with the data and keep up with the reality on the ground of the U.S. economy, then you can get behind and the expectations can get away from you and inflation can get away from you. I'm not saying we're there now, but monetary policy is a long way from normal, a long, long way from normal. It's not just like we're, you know, we kind of have some interest rates that look a little bit low. I mean, we've been at zero for a long time here, and we've got the very big balance sheet. We haven't even stopped purchases yet. So I think we've got a lot of, you know, a long way to go on normalization, and it's, you know, it takes a long time to get that whole process going, and you know, you want to be doing it in the teeth of a, you know, continually improving economy, and I think we're getting that now, and so that we're in a better position to start that process.
You know, I think you may be the only member of the FOMC who's been critical of policy for being too tight and too loose. You were critical of the Fed, and you dissented when it was allowing inflation to fall below the target and not doing anything about it. So it was a pretty big deal. And in fact, the minutes even include this special kind of caveat now that persistent below target inflation can do damage. And that really seems to have been, that occurred after your dissent. Now you're a clear voice trying, it seems, saying to the Fed, you know, to the world, hey, look at the economy, it's improving. This interest rate increase, you've been saying this for a while, is going to come sooner than people are looking for it. How did you shift from, hey, don't dismiss low inflation, that's where my concern is, to now looking at the other side and saying we may have to raise the interest rate sooner and quicker?
I did dissent on the dovish side last summer at the June meeting, and at that time, you know, inflation was running surprisingly low, and I felt at the time that we didn't have a good explanation. I'm not sure we have a good explanation for why inflation was as low as it was during 2013, but during 2014 here, you know, the readings have come back up some. We're still below target, and they seem to be moving in the right direction, which is more consistent with what we've been thinking. And so now, and plus we've got the dramatic improvement in labor markets, and so I think and we've got monetary policy sort of way away from normal settings, and so those three things, you know, together make me think that maybe we should get started on the normalization process.
Well, at least you've proven this, that people can be wrong, that everyone's a hawk or a dove, because you fly with both wings. You have to.
Well, I try not to be, you know, sort of overly dogmatic. I try to look as carefully as I can at the situation and think about where I can maybe improve based on where the committee is.
This is a labor market conference, after all, here at Jackson Hole. And for years, the Kansas City Fed has had this uncanny knack for, like, almost a year ahead, picking a topic that when you get to August, it's like, wow, right on. Uh-huh. Now, Janet Yellen, the Fed chair, many times in speeches, in testimony, has talked about labor market slack and that there's too much of it and there's too many people who've been unemployed for a long time, and seems to link this to the Fed's ability to move slowly and let inflation get up to target. Number one, you in the past, in your own research, have questioned this concept of labor market slack. What is your position on that now?
Well, I've said many times, I don't think labor market slack's a good way to organize your thinking about monetary policy. But, you know, I can appreciate that there are different views on that, and I'm happy to be here at the conference. I'll probably learn a lot on this issue. What I've felt in the past, and what I've said in the past, and I'll just repeat here, is that theoretical underpinnings of slack are not good. There is a leading theory out there, but the kinds of gaps that we look at are not the kinds of gaps that are in the theory. And so there's a mismatch there. That's one problem. And then even if you don't want to worry about economic theory like I do, you just want to say, look at the data, tell me what's related to what. So you just run regressions of inflation on slack variables. The slack doesn't really help you that much. And so I think this, you know, the kinds of mechanical relationships that sometimes get talked about in financial markets about slack, you know, don't really hold in the data. So that's another key problem. So.
Well, in a nutshell, you and your team at the St. Louis Fed, one of your recent presentations, and I love the new bullet point format you do now, looking at the unemployment and price stability and how close the Fed is to them. And your conclusion is that right now, when it comes to unemployment, the Fed is pretty much very close to where it needs to be. This is another argument for why you think the Fed is much closer to needing to go ahead and raise the rate.
Yeah, with inflation coming up this year and unemployment coming down pretty dramatically, we're quite close to our goals now. And I've felt that, you know, we've been at these low interest rates for such a long time that I think people, you know, sometimes they see the data, but they, you know, they might still be thinking 2011 or 2012 or something. But there has been a lot of improvement recently. Unemployment's only about 80 basis points off the committee's median guess about the sort of long-run unemployment rate, and inflation's only maybe 40 basis points away. So that's actually pretty close by historical standards. We've certainly missed by far larger amounts than that on both sides of the mandate. So so I think we're much closer to goals. And then combine that with the funds rate still 350, 400 basis points away from normal. The way the committee usually moves, it would take a long time to get back up to even a normal level, much less something that would be tighter policy. Plus, you've got the balance sheet, over $4 trillion. How are we going to get on a path to get that back to normal?
Well, and yet there are certainly some signals, some would say, would suggest there's no hurry to move yet. Now, you've looked at hours worked getting back to their cycle peak and heading higher, so that's a healthier labor market. But some say, look at consumer spending. It's not accelerating. We've got confidence not, you know, back to, you know, expansionary kind of peaks. And say this is potentially a sign that there's a low-wage problem percolating in the economy. Is that a concern for you, and is that a reason for the Fed to give it a little more time?
Yeah, I think this is like, you know, this is not a story about today, but it's a story about possibly being out of position over the next 2 years, let's say, by moving too slowly. Because you are seeing an economy that's growing at a reasonable pace, over 3%. On a potential growth rate that most people have marked down to only a little over 2%. So 3% growth is above trend growth, and that's showing in pretty clear improvements in labor markets. This 200,000 a month, and I actually think if I've got my numbers right, it's been 200,000 a month since we launched QE3. You can compare that to, let's say, the 2004, 2003 to 2007 period. It wasn't as strong during that period, and that was a bubble. That was a bubble in the U.S. economy. So, I think we are seeing good improvement in labor markets, and that's part of what's driving this. So,
I'm sure you hear it, you see it in the paper. Maybe someone says this isn't a recovery, like the people here in Jackson Hole, about a dozen who have come from various parts of the country who've been unemployed for a long time or have. We're out of work and have gotten jobs at half the salaries. One young woman I talked to with a master's degree. So they're frustrated. They say the Fed doesn't get it. This isn't a recovery. And I think this wages and this weakness in the labor market, people working part-time because they can't find full-time, is a reason why. How does the labor market look to you, quite apart from what it means for Fed policy?
Let me be clear. I'm talking about optimal monetary policy, the very best that you can do. So what I'm suggesting is what I think would be the very best that you can do. And, you know, you look at 2004 to 2006. The Fed stayed too low for too long. I suppose we all slapped each other on the back about that. But boy, what a disaster. Total disaster. You allowed the housing prices to get out of hand. We told ourselves stories that nothing bad was going to happen. They dropped by 30%. It was a global disaster. So, you know, if we're fomenting something like that again, that's not optimal. That's not going to be good for anybody. It's not going to be good for, you know, any of the categories that you just mentioned. So, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind that there's, you know, there's more to a really good monetary policy than just saying, you know, you have to keep interest rates low at every single juncture.
So are you saying, though, Jim, that that is the risk the Fed runs, that we all run, if the Fed moves too slowly and gets behind the curve?
I think there's a dual risk. One would be inflation, but the other would be financial stability, and it's substantial.
Well, let's take a look about the bond market, because if you just took yields at face value, you know, you had the 10-year note down around 2.5, then 2.4, even below 2.4% on the U.S. 10-year Treasury note. They don't look to be worried about inflation at this point. Are they wrong?
They don't, but I think the source of the global bond rally is that there's a specter of the ECB coming in with a major QE program. I don't have a sense of if they'll do that or whether they'll do that, but that's what the market is thinking, partly because European inflation has come in at such a low level, only about 40 basis points on their latest reading, well below their inflation target. So even though the ECB is just has a single goal of price stability, they're way below their goal. So it's a good question what their next move is going to be, but you can see that European yields have dropped dramatically. The German yield is under 1%, and that's dragged down global yields. So I think that's a lot of what's been going on here. I would also say that on inflation in the U.S., I think there is a global factor in inflation. So, you know, part of what happens to our inflation rate is what else is going on around the world, and that you know, there is correlation across countries and inflation rates is pretty substantial. So if the rest of the world is seeing a downdraft in their inflation rate, then we will too. And so I think we're getting some of that effect. So I actually think that this year, the fact that inflation has come up, even when global inflation has been falling a bit, is a sign that inflation is coming back to target in the U.S.
Well, it seems that we get more and more numbers. You know, the economic numbers on Europe are not getting better. They seem to be getting worse. You know, more bad numbers out of Germany. And one of the guests on my show recently said, oh, and how could the Fed move now? How could the Fed signal a move to raise the rate at a time when you've got the Ukraine-Russia conflict and the sanctions and Europe getting weaker? This would not be prudent. Of course the Fed wouldn't make a move at a time like this.
Well, I don't know what your guest was thinking, but let me just paint the picture the opposite way. U.S. is growing at 3%. Unemployment's dropped a point over the last year. Job growth is robust, and they're a long way from normal. They should get going on normalization. And then for Europe, you know, they might look to additional stimulus. Although, you know, and I have advocated QE for Europe, and then it seems like you get the exchange rate movements in the direct, at least pressure would go in the direction that you want, given that situation, a slowing Europe and a growing U.S.
So what about Japan? I just want to ask that because I know you for years that's an area you study. You study their monetary policy. Abenomics is underway. Is it working? Is Japan on the right track?
Well, we're going to hear from the Bank of Japan here at this conference. So I'm anxious to hear what Governor Kuroda has to say. And, you know, it's been a bold experiment, and they just went through a key piece of it when they raised the consumption tax here in the spring. So I think the jury's still out, even after everything that's happened. They have managed to move inflation expectations higher after decades of not being able to do that, and that's impressive. So maybe they'll be able to break out of it, but I don't think they're out of the woods yet.
Are you past the point is the Fed past the point of having any concern about the emerging markets at the time a move is signaled by the Fed?
Well, of course, that's always a concern. And the last year's Jackson Hole conference was practically the whole conference, as far as I could tell, was about emerging markets and the effect of U.S. policy on emerging markets. So I have talked about that in speeches. I do think that you can sketch a theory that would that would support the views of emerging markets. I tried to do that in a couple speeches, but still, I come to the conclusion that really the U.S. has to run monetary policy for the U.S. and the foreign economies have to run their monetary policy for their economies. And there's no real better answer to that right now than that. I have worried that because we're doing so many unconventional things in the U.S., that it's hard for those outside the U.S. to read the signals about U.S. monetary policy, and that has maybe complicated the global equilibrium more than we're used to pre-crisis. So I think it's a long, rambling answer, but that's but I have thought about this issue partly in response to last year's Jackson Hole meeting.
Exit strategy. The last minutes noted that the FOMC is talking about this. At this stage, it's probably not too early, because if you are right and the interest rate gets raised in March and the taper's done, people are going to be wondering more and more about the quote-unquote exit strategy, and particularly in the bond market, because it could potentially has a big impact on them. What are some of your early thoughts? Do you have any definite idea or even hypothesis about what's going to be important then, what you would suggest as a bunch of tools, a path?
The committee has been thinking about this issue and has been making preparations. The staff has been thinking about this issue really for a couple years, but we've intensified that effort recently as we get closer here to the time when we might actually raise rates. So I think we've got a good set of tools that we can use. We have interest rate on excess reserves. We have a federal funds market, which is a mere shadow of its former self, but I think we can maintain some of the focus on the federal funds rate on the grounds that that's the usual rate that we've used to communicate to people. And then we've got this overnight reverse repo facility, which I think will set a floor under the federal funds rate. So if we can move those three rates in tandem, then I think it'll be pretty clear signaling to markets as to where the Fed stands and where short-term interest rates stand. So I think we're in pretty good shape. There are risks. We've never done this before, so we don't know exactly how it'll work. But I do think that we're in pretty good shape. I think we will maintain a focus on the federal funds rate, even though that market is not really very robust at this point.
Depending on how you read the minutes that were just released, you might see a reluctance to use the reverse repo facility. The minutes use the phrase, quote, temporary use on a limited scale. How are you going to target the Fed funds rate successfully without robust use of the reverse RP facility?
Well, I think with a limited program, you'd still set a pretty solid floor under the federal funds rate. And we are talking about a range, at least in my mind, between the IOER and the overnight reverse repo rates of 25 basis points. So I don't think it would have to be, that large of a program. Possibly several hundred billion would be enough to set a good floor there. And then Fed funds should trade in between those two rates. So that's what I'm expecting, at least as of right now. If we wanted to, if that didn't work, the committee could revisit that and increase the size of the program if we thought that was necessary. But I think there is a sense on the committee and maybe myself as well that we kind of want to keep the option open at least to get back to normal someday, where you'd be back to a low reserve environment, you'd be able to target the federal funds rate as we have done historically and successfully, and that that would be the way we would operate. But we can't operate that way in this very high reserves environment, and so that's why we've got these other tools.
Well, there's a lot of things that have changed, it seems. It's been an extraordinary 5 or 6 years, hasn't it? Can monetary policy, can the Fed kind of ever go back to where it was now? I mean, is this, you went and done Charted Waters, you've done things you've never done, you're going to do more. Is it going to be, a world that, you don't go back. You don't just say, okay, now we just target the funds rate. Thank you very much. But there's new tools. And in fact, some would say a very activist Fed, a Fed that controls a lot more than it used to, can the Fed back away from that now?
Well, I think it is a time of change for central banking around the world, and I think it's unpredictable at this point whether we'll be able to, go completely back to normal, defined as, say, the 1990s or the 2000s. There may be permanent changes in central banking. However, I would just stress that the only thing the central bank can do in the medium term and the long run is control the price level. So in that sense, I think, the fundamentals haven't changed. But how we go about that and conceptions of what optimal monetary policy looks like might be changing.
Okay. I guess my final question, because I'm thinking of baseball and I'm thinking of the Cardinals, to get back to where we started, if this were a baseball game, okay, what inning is the Fed in when it comes to monetary policy?
Well, it's not a baseball game because you've got incoming data and you've got to react to the incoming data. So it's, baseball game is delineated by the outs that have to be made and in order to define the end of the game. And so I think it's not really right to think in those terms.
So, but let me ask you, I get the impression, though, that you're pretty convinced of your forecast. If the data disappoint, are you going to back off from that March forecast?
Well, I have a history of shifting views in response to the data, and so I think it wouldn't be a good day if we got weak data and we had to do that. But I have changed in the past, and I'd be keep an open mind on that. So a lot of what I'm saying is just that, tracking forecasts of GDP are over 3% for the second half. We've got all this improvement, 200,000 jobs a month. The tracking says that that'll continue through the whole year here. Unemployment will probably be down with a 5 handle in the not too distant future. Do we really need to be at rock bottom on policy in that kind of environment? I don't know.
I think what you're saying is, no, we don't.
But it's possible that, of course, it's always possible the data comes in a completely different way and there's a false dawn and there's a setback or something. But that isn't what people are expecting right now.